Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce Garner Ted Armstrong of Ambassador College with The World Tomorrow. In this series of programs, we will tell you something of the problems of the world today, how they will affect you, and their solution in The World Tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, Garner Ted Armstrong.
The biggest and the best news you can hear is that human survival is not only possible, but assured. That there will be a peaceful world tomorrow. We will still be on the Earth in another 50 years, 100, 2,000 even. Oh yes, humankind is not going to perish from the Earth, and I have that on top authority, the most scientific source to which you could go. I have that on the direct authority of that one document that really provides the basic groundwork for the creation of a brand new world ruling government. I have that on the authority of the one who has already been decided upon as the world ruler and the leader in that wonderful utopian era that is described in that same document as to what can become possible when the natural resources of the earth are used for peaceful purposes. When all the defense industries of all the big nations of the earth are changed into peaceful purposes, when there will be vast linguistic reform, agrarian reform, religious reform, economic and social reform, all of the reforms that are needed where the human family will really become one family. Believe it or not, there is a great outline, a program, a plan that was brought to this earth nearly 2,000 years ago by a man whose name is used continually. As much, I imagine, as politicians use it, golfers do, people in churches do, the man on the street does every now and then. Hardly anyone seems to know what that man said. They don't seem to know that he talked about a world-ruling government or that he offered people who were willing to get in harmony with his laws and to overcome their own human nature an opportunity to provide or to, let's say, grow and develop so that it can be provided for them. They'll have an opportunity to rule with him, a place in that government. But that's the way it goes. People have looked at his name, they've looked at a figment of history, they've looked at a personage whose name has been bandied about a great deal, but they've forgotten and almost totally buried the message that he brought. His name is Jesus Christ. He came talking about a world-ruling government. He asserted there is a God. He said he believed in Adam and Eve. He said he believed in Noah and the flood. He said he believed in Job. Well, let's see. He talked about Job, Daniel, Adam, and the Garden of Eden. He talked about Noah and the flood. He talked about these sages that people say either did or did not exist, many of whom they think lied about their own interpretations of their attempt to aggrandize their own tiny nation. Jesus, it seems, went out of his way to say he believed in things that had happened that are plainly revealed in the Old Testament of the Bible. You know that Jesus believed in God. Now, people are willing to forgive Christ for all those mistakes. They're willing to say, well, we believe that Jesus was a great man. Maybe some people think as great as Nostradamus, maybe as great as Muhammad, or maybe as great as Plato, or some people think maybe as great as Melvin McGillicuddy. But they're not quite sure that he really was the Son of God. They're not quite sure the message he brought from heaven is really for our time, or really was from a heaven, and that there really was a God the Father there. And that Jesus really did die and was really resurrected and is really going to come again. Now, actually, I'm not on any attempt to try to get you to believe that. Because, you see, I've also been told by that same authority that that's impossible. That I can't do that. I don't know how. I've been told by that same authority, whose name is Jesus Christ, none can come to the Son except the Spirit of the Father draw him. And if the Spirit of the Father is not working on your mind and is not drawing you, is not opening your mind, getting rid of some of the paraphernalia and the trash that we accumulate in our minds from all of our earliest age, from the influential personalities around us, from our teachers, from our textbooks, from society in general, and especially the education part of it and the religion part of it, I really couldn't change your mind at all unless God, through a miracle, is working on your mind to let you begin to accept what he says. But let's just indulge, like science does oftentimes, in a few perhapses and could-bes and possiblys. If there could be a God, if there is a God, would he have left humankind without a record of his existence? Would he have left us with no proof whatsoever? And would he have come along with a whole series of laws that demand consequences and penalties, and then sneak up on us. Here we've been working so hard, we've been developing, and our ingenuity and our science has taken us along to a jet age, now into the space age. We've been striving in all of our colors and races, religions, languages, and creeds for world peace, ineffectively, in sometimes ludicrous fashion. But is he going to sneak up on us someday and say, now, why didn't you do what I told you to? And here I was so evident that I proved myself to you and so on. Yes, that's just about exactly what he's going to do. He shows the evidence that he exists is all around us. The air you breathe is evidence. Your eyesight, your human mind, the human hand, the wings of a fly, the feathers of a bird, a sunset, water, the laws of science, the rocks beneath our feet, the living creatures all around us, all of these, according to the Bible, are proofs that God exists. Now, last time I had to break off for a lack of time, and I was zeroing in on just one kind of what is called a rock, that isn't really a rock, which is coal. And I was showing how here is the example of interbedding, of crossbedding, of strata beneath the surface of our feet in this earth, all over the United States. I showed you how coal is found in the Rocky Mountains, the Appalachian Mountains, in the great Mississippi Valley, in Oregon, Washington, and California. It's found in practically every state. It's found all over the world. And what is coal? Well, I'll go to the article in the encyclopedia to tell you what coal is, and I want you to notice some fantastic opposites in this article. Now, I've called coal, as so many people have, fossil fuels, and talked about pollution from burning fossil fuels. Some people call it stored sunshine. So it says underneath this picture, the plants that helped to form coal ranged, listen very carefully to this, from delicate mosses, ferns, and rushes to the largest trees. Now think about that for a minute. You've taken a walk in the forest, no doubt, in the past, and you've seen great tree trunks lying there. How'd they get there? Well, you might say, well, they died. Sure. How long ago did they die? Well, there are ways to measure that. You can probably take a look at a tree. I've seen cases where in the redwoods, for example, there may be the roots of one tree that are actually growing atop of another tree, and maybe you could cut this first tree down. Don't you do it, but in case somebody in the Forest Service has, you can count the rings. And you know, then, how long that first tree has been there. About this time, though, it's rotten and completely decomposed, isn't it? But the point is that coal is something which was virtually buried alive. It was buried while all that energy was still there. It wasn't given off. It didn't change too much. It was in a state of decomposition, surely. And yet, here are the ferns that you can see beautiful pictures of. The plants that helped to form coal range from delicate mosses, it says. Ferns, and here is a picture. You can see the lacy, delicate shape of the leaf of a fern on this sample of coal. And it says the largest trees. Now, what am I getting at? Well, it should be obvious to you by now that when ferns and little leaves and delicate things and large trees are all found in a homogeneous mass, uprooted, carried by the water action of sorting, deposition of that particular layer of vegetable material. And remember, to get 1 foot of coal, it takes anywhere from 5 to 8 feet of that vegetable material, that vegetation. So you got 20 feet of coal. It took 5 to 8 times that much in thickness to deposit that coal in its original raw form. You've got 2 feet of coal. It took anywhere from 10 to 16 feet of vegetable material, waterborne, deposited, then a horrible avalanche of mud deposited over that. Another one from another direction of a different constituency deposited over that. And then another one from another direction deposited over that. Then maybe another seam of coal. Now here's the source of energy, of heat and light, electrical power. It's so commonplace. Coal mines are everywhere in practically every state. They're a pollution problem today. It's one of the world's great natural resources. Isn't it lucky that this massive burial did occur? Here's one point before I tell you how it's true that they were buried alive, and you can prove it. And you could prove it in a courtroom trial. And that is that you can't decide in advance you're about to discover coal by some kind of rock that is near it. The roof of a coal seam can be of any material. The metals that are found in association with it can be practically anything. The colors can go to every extreme range. A coal seam can be from 1 inch thick to 20 feet thick. You can have a seam of coal, a seam of shale, limestone, sandstone, coal. Shale, coal. Limestone, coal. some other kind of coal. You can have lignite at the bottom and the bituminous coal at the top, and even the sub-bituminous coal down below that. You can have all kinds of formations. They can be interwoven. They can be shuffled like a deck of cards. Sandstone or clay and shale and so on, then coal, and then sandstone and coal, and on. So what does this prove? It proves that what even the textbooks try to tell you about how coal was formed is absolutely wrong, and that they are contradicting themselves. It proves that ancient peat bogs, ancient swamps, into which giant ferns were supposed to have fallen, did not provide this world with its coal reserves. It proves it. Because when you've got a delicate fern that falls into a swamp, what does it do? It decomposes. It becomes absolutely undefinable, indistinguishable. In a matter of days, it does this. You couldn't keep the thing fresh on your own dining room table for very long, even with water. It's going to gradually decay. Then it's going to curl up. Okay, you put it in water, what happens? Especially if there's any kind of a tidal action. Surely the uniformitarianists don't want us to suspend the action of the moon and the earth, do they? So they can have their theories. They're not going to suspend tidal action in large inland lakes or swamps, or the action of wind or waves. The sorting action, the eroding action of the action of water? Well, I hope not. If you've been to lakes and rivers, you've seen that in a matter of days, leaves and vegetable material are completely torn apart and disintegrated. They're not preserved this way. They were buried alive, and this is one of the important proofs there is a God. It's only in a context of many other larger proofs, but it's certainly one of the very important ones, and one that I think anyone from a tiny child ought to be able to understand.
Hundreds of years, man sought to imitate the flight of birds. By observing the mechanics of bird flight, he gradually learned the principles of aerodynamics. By staying within the limits these laws impose, he can now fly at supersonic speeds. All of this is possible by using the laws of flight, energy, motion, gravity. Yet man did not invent these laws, he only named them. The existence of law necessitates the existence of a lawgiver. To find out how this fact is one of the strongest proofs a creator God exists, be sure to read the free booklet, Seven Proofs God Exists.
If the police department had been notified of suspected foul play in the death of someone, they had unearthed the body after they got an appropriate clearance from the authorities and the powers that be, and they discovered a body inside a coffin that was in a tortured position, as if it had died through paroxysms of agony and strangulation. I think that the coroner's report and the autopsy and the observation of scientists and specialists and just the eyewitness account of how that body was found when they first opened that coffin would be ample testimony to demonstrate that, sure enough, the poor person had been buried alive. There is a place in southern Italy called Pompeii, and here is a whole city that was buried alive. Vesuvius, the well-known volcano, had exploded, and volcanic ash, tons of it, spewed up into the air, formed giant clouds, and came raining down, just like soft pumice stone, but mostly ash, and began piling up very rapidly. Many people fled and got out, but many others did not. Thousands of years go by. The archaeologist Spade one day discovered Pompeii. They began excavating and digging. Every now and then as they were digging, they would come to a crusty area and hear a hollow sound, and then crunch, and they'd fall through, and they'd begin to discover, grisly though it may sound, some bones. And they began to realize they were discovering human bones. And then someone thought, I think what we're discovering is decomposed bodies, which as they were buried in this pumice, this ash that accumulated, decomposed. And so what we ought to do is to tap and very carefully try to preserve these forms and see what went on, what it was like. So they were tapping around, they'd hear a hollow sound, they would drill just a little hole. They would pour in some solidified material of some type. I don't know what it is, maybe plaster of Paris, very likely, and I don't think cement, but plaster of Paris. And then when it hardened, they would scrape around it, and sure enough, they found bodies of people, of dogs and animals and so on, and they were in torturous positions. Now, today, if you were to go there to the museum that is at Pompeii, you would see these very bodies that I'm talking about. So they made a mold by pouring this material into this hollow space where these bodies had disintegrated. And it proved, absolutely demonstrated, that these people were buried alive. Some of them with their arms over their heads and in positions that showed they suffocated. When you look in the rocks under your feet, and you find a crushed body of a shark that is in a swimming position, but the rocks subsequently on top of that shark have pressed it down to where it's just embedded in rock. What is your observation? You don't need to be a geologist. You don't need to be anybody. You can be a housewife. You can be a schoolboy. You don't have to have a degree up to your name to see what your own eyes tell you. You know that fish was buried alive. Now, what does it take to bury a shark alive? Well, it takes a fisherman, I guess, with a hook, I guess, a piece of pig on it, a lot of very powerful men, a big net, a big hole, and get him in there before he dies, and then put lots of rocks on him, and then jump around on it and keep him there, doesn't it? But that's kind of silly because there are millions of sharks that were buried alive and all at the same time. Not by men with fish hooks, but by a gigantic catastrophe of some sort, which buried those sharks as well as many other myriad forms of fish and other living creatures alive. And those living creatures began to disintegrate, and they began to collect as the body decomposition would form in various pools, and over the many years, they formed our oils and some of the raw materials and resources that are beneath the surface of this earth. Same comment about vegetable material, except the vegetable material formed coal. Now, here in this same encyclopedia is the picture of this delicate fern fossil and the statement that coal is made up of everything from mosses and ferns to the very largest trees. And I've shown time and again that if it isn't buried alive, it isn't preserved because it decomposes. You're walking along the beach and somebody says, "What's that horrible odor there?" And you smell this terrible stench. It may be the rotting carcass of a fish or a whale or a shark that was tossed up by the tide. What happens to it? It disintegrates. The birds pick it apart. Finally, only bleached bones are left. Rodents gnaw at those. And finally, even the bones are disintegrated and become little bits of what appears to be seashell or sand. And finally, even those are gone. Unless it is buried, unless it is preserved, unless it is fossilized, it completely disintegrates. Now, coal is a fossil stratum of rock. Here is an example of the way coal is laid down. And it's done this way right out of a textbook, which shows how there has been tidal action that has brought in sands, sandstones, clays. And here's a cheaper kind of coal where it's mixed with fire clay, pebbles, and gypsum. And here's another layer. Then here's some pretty hard coal down below. It shows the sand, the clay, and the soft sandstone. Now, this is accurate. This is from a textbook. In many cases, you can have interruptions of this to where you would have erosion. Maybe a couple of miles distant, this would be formed into a valley. Then over here in another mountainside, you would find the same coal seam. And you could determine that erosion had gouged out a valley, but that this actually was a contiguous area, that it was all one layer, one series of strata that were all set down at approximately the same time. Now, was coal deposited slowly over aeons of time? In a moment, I'll show you how this one encyclopedia is contradictory only inside itself, because the entire approach of most of this kind of education is evolutionary. So they have to try to tell you how coal was formed gradually. This chart proves that it wasn't formed gradually. Coal proves it wasn't formed gradually. Pick up a piece of it and look at it, and it tells you it was not formed gradually. But, you know, people aren't going to accept that kind of evidence because God is involved. I'm telling you that there was a God, that what the Bible shows about the burial, the mass avalanche of burials of animals and of plants, is absolutely harmonious with what the Bible says about the creation week in Genesis 1 and the flood even during the Noahian deluge.
There's one question that has bothered man for centuries, but it probably has bothered you also. Average men and great philosophers alike have struggled with this monumental problem, but it's a question that needs answering. The question is, does God exist? And if so, how can you prove it? The free booklet, Does God Exist?, offers tangible information that will help you answer this timeless question. You'll learn how matter, intelligence, and design prove the literal existence of a spiritual God. Everyone has an opinion. But how many have the facts? There's no greater question that means so much to your own daily life and peace of mind. Does God exist? Now you can know beyond any doubt. Write for your free copy of Does God Exist?
In one of the encyclopedias on the subject of coal, it tells you how coal was formed. And in this exposition, it shows how dense forests and swamps covered much of the Earth's surface hundreds of millions of years ago. So far, no contradiction with the Bible. I know that many people that go into the Bible think the Bible contradicts that. People assume that the Bible says the whole thing, the whole shooting match, the entire world and everybody on it was created in 1 week, not quite 6,000 years ago. The Bible says nothing of the kind. The Bible allows, in the book of Genesis, the first few verses, for any indeterminate period of aeons of time, the Bible plainly allows for a pre-Adamic creation, where plants and animals of all kinds and types once teemed on this earth. The Bible allows, and Bible commentaries and other books reveal, that there was a program that God had in mind, that there was a great God, a designer, who over aeons of time was preparing this earth for man's habitation. There is just as much proof for God in the study of geology as there is any remote, wild, imaginary reason to suppose God does not exist because there are cataclysms. Natural laws and forces and energies, yes, but uniformitarianism is disproved everywhere you look. Uniformitarianism, in short, is that theory, a portion of evolutionary theory, which suggests that everything that you see today is a guide to what happened in the past. That everything in the past went along pretty much as it is today. Take a look at coal, and you simply cannot understand their reasoning. Here's the way they say it was formed. It says, hundreds of millions of years ago, these swamps were filled with strange-looking trees, giant rushes, and wide-spreading ferns. Among the plants lived big lizards and giant insects. Okay, so far so good. No quarrel with the Bible. As the giant plants died, they fell into the swamps. The dead trees and ferns became tangled in a mass of decayed vegetable matter. Now, so far so good, that's true in many cases, except not all, because much of coal, not all, but a lot of coal, has fossils clearly visible that show the finest hair-like particles of ferns, mosses, plants, even to the branches of huge trees such as big pines. And that is evidence. Just as much as those bodies at Pompeii, and just as much as that body we suppose might have been exhumed and was found in a tortured condition in a coffin, represents evidence of having been buried alive, not of a gradual falling into a swamp, plop, and lying there for 5 years, disintegrating, and gradually, you know, swamps don't really move around a lot. They just stay there and stink. And coal, most of the coal on this earth's surface, that is found interbedded, cross-bedded. The seam can be 5 feet thick and its terminus can be 1 inch thick. That proves, absolutely proves, that vast floating rafts of uprooted vegetable material were heaved and tossed by tidal action as the continents themselves were raised or lowered, and the Bible allows for a number of times of continental raisings and lowerings. There is no conflict between God's word and what geology plainly proves, what geology speculates about the idea that at the very bottom are simple forms of life. What's simple about a trilobite? And at the top is man. That is a question, because you see, the geologic sequence of strata is nowhere found in that perfect form on the face of the earth. As a matter of fact, there are exceptions to that all over the earth, but they try to get around it with things like deceptive conformity, interbedding, and overthrust faults, and all kinds of explanations, some of which may partially be true, but most of which simply do not hold water. It says here that new plants grew on top of the old. Then they too died and became part of the mass of peat. But the mass of peat, a kind of indefinable stuff that looks like it's been put through the household blender, is not sufficient to account for the seams of coal that can be 15, 20, or more feet thick of coal that shows the imprints of delicate mosses and ferns. That's proof for burial alive, and that means a giant catastrophe, not one, but several. I honestly believe that much of the coal of the United States of America and the rest of the earth was buried prior to the creation of Adam. believe that it represents a pre-Adamic creation, and believe that the gouges and the big canyons that have eroded away through it and have exposed it to the eye of man happened at the Noachian deluge. Now, maybe I'm dumb. You can disagree with me if you'd like. But I do believe, too, that your eyes would show you by looking at such a phenomenon as the Grand Canyon, that those huge layers of rock that are mixed with an evenness that your own blender couldn't provide in the kitchen, miles and miles and miles of them, absolutely even. What does that show? Does that show gradual accumulation over years with windstorm and with water and freezing and thawing and the tracks of animals and the decaying vegetable matter? Oh, no, it sure doesn't. No, it's solid sandstone and clay stones and shales and other kinds of rocks that are smooth and are perfectly harmonious and sometimes 20 or more feet thick. That shows sudden deposition, water-carried, water-borne, water-sorted, water-deposited. How'd the Grand Canyon get there after all that was deposited? By that one little river, in comparison with its vast size, over aeons of time? Then where'd all those big angular boulders come from downstream that are the same constituency as the rocks inside the canyon? Well, Jesus believed in a vast flood on the surface of this earth, but that doesn't account for coal and everything else that was deposited. There were quite a few, and the Bible does not take any exception to that whatsoever. Well, there are seven proofs God exists. Now, this booklet that we'll send you by return mail free of charge shows you these are not guesses, but factual proofs. It's not a weighty booklet. It's a very short, very brief booklet that I imagine you can read in less than 20 minutes. It's just that simple. If you're discussing religion, which oftentimes is not too good an idea, religion isn't always a very exciting subject over dinner, is it? Because it tends to get into arguments and people get a little touchy about religion. But if you want some ammunition, you're discussing whether or not there is a God with a person who is mildly skeptic or really does doubt it, an atheist or a friend of yours that just can't see the proof. I've met many people, heard of many people, who have said there can't be a God because, and then they begin to talk about Vietnam, or starvation, or accidents, or warfare, or sickness, or a loved one of theirs that was a very great person, but who died of throat cancer with seemingly no cause. And people have, well, many reservations, many doubts. They wonder whether or not there really is a God. You write for this booklet if you want some real solid proofs for further research and discussion on your own part. All seven of them, one after another, very tangible, easy to read, simple to understand. And it's free of charge. There is no price whatsoever. Now, also, while you're writing for the seven proofs God exists, write for the booklet that is its companion, Does God Exist? If you ask for the booklets on Does God Exist, we'll send them both to you. Seven proofs God exists and the one, Does God Exist? And all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.